Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. We're finally able to get back out into the hills after all the snow and the rain and the battering winds and have a nice walk. So we're recording our podcast outside today. So I hope you're all following the Reason on Reason series. It's just been Pete so far, but I'm joining in today. And this is episode 4, simply entitled Madness. So straight to it then. Big question, what is madness? And why is it important?
We're not going to get a definition, like so many of the topics that I find myself concerned with.
Yeah. Oh, this is a very big topic.
It's a huge topic. I'm more concerned to paint a picture. If I can use like the metaphor of picturing. But mainly because it'll help us to understand reason. Now, if you've got reason, you've also got the loss of reason, particularly madness was characterised in the 18th century as a loss of reason. And reason was considered to be a faculty, as was passion and so forth. There's an idea that had a lot of currency in the 18th century. So they had the age of reason, in which the loss of reason was one of the explanations for the perennial phenomenon of madness or folly or irrationality. So that's why we need to consider it. To get a picture of reason, we need to consider its counterpart. I won't say its opposite exactly, but its counterpart, madness. And why I don't want to give a definition is because the concept of madness has got a long history. I mean, there are certain phenomena which crop up over the ages of people who don't cope with ordinary life, who speak in a fashion that's not easy to understand or refuse to speak at all, or throw convulsions, or seem to speak in a prophetic way, or strangely and inexplicably violent. And but there have always been people who don't seem to understand the world the way the majority of their fellow citizens do. So,
or could be understanding the world in exactly the way that their fellow citizens or the majority of their fellow citizens do, but that's because they're all mad as well. Which is partly why we're doing this, because of the madness epidemic.
Well, I think we have to
world.
We have to consider madness as an individual phenomenon, but also as a collective phenomenon. We have to take it on board that there is a sort of collective madness possible, but it's kind of infectious.
Yeah, it absolutely is possible, and it is infectious, and it's happening right now.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is the underneath reason.
Why we're all fucked.
Yeah. Why we're all fucked, and B, why we need to kind of figure this out.
Yeah. But I'm very important. We need this mass healing as Biden keeps going on about.
Yeah.
And we need it now.
But that's why I'm concerned to arrive at a picture that's serviceable, but which is open enough for people to follow their own lines of inquiry from it, and which is reliable, in which what I say got a certain reliability. It's grounded in some demonstrable facticity at the same time as one is not going to escape the necessity of interpreting situations and historical events and a phenomena. So that's what it's for. I mean, it's partly a huge philosophical interest. That's my own kind of axe that I grind, is the philosophical axe, and I'm just doing it because it's what I do. But at the same time, it seems very urgent at this time, in this age of post-truth, alternative facts, and in which the faculty for discerning truth seems to be almost absent from public discourse, and the abilities of truth-telling and truth-discernment seem to be absent from politicians, journalists, commentators, and all the rest. So there's like an urgent practical, immediate political necessity for what I'm about to say to be said, even though, of course, I would be very pleased if one person heard what I'd got to say. And even that is unlikely. You know, so I'm not going on a messianic I'm saving the world trip with my superior understanding. But I don't think what I'm about to say needs to be said.
So I understand the reason why you don't want to have an absolute definition of madness. So you're going to paint a picture. So how are you going to do it? What method are you going to use to paint this picture of what madness is?
Well, I propose to look at the history of madness. Now, obviously, this is a short podcast, and to do a complete history of madness on a global scale would probably entail writing a 10-volume book and a lifetime of research. So I'm not actually going to give a history of madness, but I'm going to use the history of madness to flag up certain signs on this journey towards some kind of understanding through picturing. And as well as the history of madness, I want to look at the history of the way in which madness is treated. What society does about mad people, historically.
Makes them president.
Yeah, makes them president, yeah. And also, I want to look at the various meanings that madness has attributed to it, again, over the ages. And I think you'll see that by following that line, certain things jump out at us, which become constituent of our understanding of madness, and therefore of reason as well. So, the last podcast I delineated certain historical facts about reason itself, particularly through the examination of the age of reason, both in my own terms, but also in the terms of Immanuel Kant, who was a figure of the age of reason. And similarly, madness does have a history. It might be surprising you to think that madness has a history. Isn't it a thing like influenza or syphilis or measles?
Would you say the history actually goes back to, just follows the whole history of humanity, really?
Of course it does, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, now, the Greeks had quite a bit to say about it, for instance. You know, because we have this literature of over 2 millennia, extensive literature of a people who we see as our European ancestors. But you have to forgive me for being a little bit Eurocentric about this, because this is the place in which I've got the most information. But I'm not intending to see European humanity is representative of the whole of humanity. And if you go back over the podcast, you'll see how I negotiate this slight difficulty. So for now, the Greeks thought that the gods toyed with us. You know, the Greek gods were sort of somewhat mischievous, and human beings were their soap opera, and they manipulated us. They placed us in difficult situations. They made Oedipus kill his father and shag his mother for their amusement. So there's this sense that, you know, those who the gods would destroy, they first make mad. But somehow it's to do with the gods. And even some types of madness were seen as possession by a god, the Dionysian and the Bacchic. Their idea was to be possessed by the god. So in a sense, certain kinds of inspiration were a divine madness. Certain kind of wild orgiastic dancing and orgiastic behaviour was a kind of divine madness. So madness wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because it was associated with divinity. Other Greeks, later on, Hippocrates, for instance, thought, no, that is too superstitious. We need a scientific explanation. You know, even back then, these quarrels were being had. And for Hippocrates, it was like an imbalance of the humours. Now, the human body and the human health was controlled by the balance of the four humours. Yellow bile, black bile, blood and phlegm. You know, which are earth, water, fire, air, fire and air. And if they were in balance, it could produce overheating of the brain and that kind of stuff. And things like mania and what we would today call mania or schizophrenia or so forth were thought to be. Or your humours are out of balance. It's just the same kind of theory as the qi in Chinese medicine. You know. Or prana and apana in Ayurvedic medicine, or doshas, the imbalance of doshas, the imbalance of humours. These notions that there are these fundamental energies or qualities or fluids that exist in the body that need to be in balance for us to be healthy. Those kind of ideas. So you'd got religious ideas, and a little bit later you'd got quasi-scientific ideas, or materialist ideas, you might say, or medical ideas as well. And this persists, and you find all of these tropes throughout the world. You find them in indigenous cultures, as we call them. You find them in Indian culture and in Chinese culture. And this isn't like a particularly a European thing. Most of these types of explanation can be found in all kinds of places in various times. So in Europe, I mean, at one point, mental illness was thought to be demon possession. It was demons that were causing it. And therefore, you could cure it by exorcism. So it was a religious matter. And some of the early madhouses were, in fact, like monasteries. And monks and nuns would take care as a part of their Christian duty of people who couldn't manage in life because they were... their thought processes, their emotional processes weren't kind of quite in line with everybody else's, which created difficulties. And again, you find this over various periods. Sometimes madness was thought to be a moral failing, and it could be addressed by moral preaching, by getting people to live morally and to have discipline. And so you had the ideas that work. So you had asylums in which lunatics tended the gardens, and this was therapeutic for them. Work was thought to be therapeutic. So lots of explanations, some religious, some which cast madness in quite a good light. You know, you have the notion of the holy fool, and in Shakespeare, in King Lear, the fool comes out with these riddles which are actually quite wise. But they sound like the riddling speech of a schizophrenic. Or perhaps in India, the idea of masti, or madmen of God, people who are divinely intoxicated. In the West, they'd be considered mad. And in the context of Hinduism, or even in Islam, you've got the same phenomenon, the madmen of God. They would be considered somehow agents of the divine, and would be treated with a certain kind of respect and care, even though they, by Western modern standards, would be considered to be barking mad. So there's a whole lot of contexts and a lot of explanations. And we're still living with different explanations. Are people schizophrenic because their mothers weren't up to mothering them properly? This was put out. It was an idea that received a lot of consideration in the 1960s throughout the West. Or was it to do with family traumas? Or was it really a matter of miscommunication, as R.D. Lang put forward in books like Self and Others and The Divided Self? Which could be understood through some kind of communications theory, that actually the mad person was actually being very, very rational. But we couldn't understand them, but they were trying to express their pain and their suffering. Same psychological explanations, communications theory explanations. At the same time as all that's going on in the 1960s, mainstream allopathic psychiatry is saying, well, again, it's an imbalance in the brain of chemicals, and therefore we treat it with medication. There's too much serotonin. This kind of thing, various ideas. I mean, the idea that it was called that madness was caused by a toxin had an enormous amount of currency. I think Jung believed, having had a mescaline experience, that that schizophrenia was caused by a toxin, that there was some kind of metabolic dysfunction. It was perhaps like a breakdown of adrenaline, like adrenochrome. Of course, if you remember in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, when Hunter S. Thompson drinks a bottle of adrenochrome and has the weirdest trip of his life. And it's like a breakdown, you know, a metabolic byproduct of adrenaline. So that would make some kind of sense, because people who are too very, very stressed have nervous breakdowns. And okay, so their body is flooding their system with adrenaline all the time for no reason, and there's no way of burning it off. There's nowhere to flee to. So...
And then there was the whole hysteria, treating women with hysteria business, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Should we talk about that now?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of the things... I mean, let's give some kind of idea of how wild and diverse the theories of cause are. I mean, hysteria was a disease of 19th century Europe, confined to women, obviously. And hysteria comes from the Greek word hysteron, the womb. And it was thought that the womb wandered around in the body and caused some women to be a bit sort of highly strung, shall we say.
But interestingly, the cure, very bizarre.
Well, some very bizarre cures. I mean, hysterectomy was one of them. Clitoridectomy, removing the clitoris.
Yes. That, even very, though that very was delightful for them,
that,
I'm
that,
sure.
That was a cure for nymphomania. You get women in asylums who just kind of like masturbate all day. Once you're locked in an asylum, there's nothing to do. You're probably just masturbate all day, you know. So they've just removed.
But then it was, you know, you go to the doctor and have a medical wank.
Yeah. It's called an hysterical paroxysm. Hysterical paroxysm. So rich women would go, and the doctor would put up a little screen, kind of something to do, and then he'd sort of. They play with their parts.
I will never cease to be absolutely amazed and stunned by that happened. That actually really happened.
Yeah, and they'd have their hysterical paroxysm and give him 50 guilders or whatever it was in Vienna, you know, where it was very popular. And so next week,
but
doctor...
You went to the doctors for an orgasm. That's just amazing.
Yeah, well, there you
amazing.
Go. So there's, mental illness, you might want to call it, hasn't always been medicalised. It's been considered under religion. It's been considered under a whole range of medical explanations, you know, from the physical to the psychological. Is it all psychological? Is it a toxin? Nobody ever found a toxin. There's no blood test for schizophrenia. And then the other thing is the thing called nosological drift, which is an interesting thing to do, is to read classifications of mental illness, of types of mental illness since they came about. Which, I mean, there always have been, you know, there's been like a distinction between an hysteric and a demon-possessed person, or a witch, you know, or whatever, you know, or a holy fool, whatever. But, you know, since the Enlightenment, of course, there was an attempt to make medicine scientific along the lines of Newtonian physics. I mean, obviously, it's not the same type of thing, and it's not really going to work, but there was the ambition. And there still is the ambition, you know, for a scientific and medicine as we can possibly get. But in psychiatry, it really is a tall order. And the way psychiatrists have worked for a couple of hundred years is to try and classify through observation. So observation does come into it. And if you compare somebody like Kraepelin, I think he was writing in the 19th century, with the DSM-5, the latest edition of a couple of years ago. So-called mental diseases appear and disappear. There are diseases that no longer exist because the classification changed. It's called nosological drift. I mean, Kraepelin, he'd got three types of schizophrenia. He'd got paranoid schizophrenia, which is what it what it says on the tin. We've still got that.
Still a popular one.
Still a popular one, yeah. Hebephrenia, which is like silly dementia. He didn't call it schizophrenia. Actually, Jung coined the term schizophrenia. What has he got? He'd got hebephrenia, paranoia, a dementia simplex. I think that was silly dementia. Catatonia, which is either you know, completely mute and still and stiff and unmoving, alternating with being very, very agitated and dancing and walking. This thing called, you know, it's like ambulatory catatonia, where you just have to go for a walk. I think I got that, because if I don't have a walk, I'm not happy. Yeah. And none of these things exist now. You know, there's a whole different classificatory system. And if you actually look at the DSM, if you look under depression, for instance, there's a questionnaire that the psychiatrist asks a patient. I don't know how many, it's like 10 questions. And you tick the box. And if they tick 5 out of the 10, they've got depression. 5 or more, but 4, you haven't got depression. But you kind of think, well, why not 6? Why not 7? Why not 3? It's kind of very, very arbitrary. So you have this thing, nosological drift, alongside the way in which different ages interpret mental illness differently, as to cause, as to treatment, as to meaning. You find that is why one becomes reluctant to define it. You know, one becomes aware that it is. A phenomenon with a lot of mystery around it, a lot of complexity, a lot of diversity, which is why we can still paint a picture of it. Out of the history, it helps us to paint a picture of it, and it helps us not to be too hasty in thinking we can kind of sign, seal and deliver it with a dictionary definition at the same time. Because obviously it's contextual. And of course people get labelled mad in order to police their behaviour. Yeah? And sometimes that means locking them up in an asylum. Sometimes punishing. I mean, in the history of madness in the West, these difficult mad people were sometimes punished. Because it was thought, well, they're mad. Madness is a sin. You know, it's a repudiation of one's God-given rationality. And so these people have to be punished back into sanity. You know? So you've got that, and you get police in because you've got troublesome people. Sometimes families, if they could afford it, would lock their relatives away in the 17th and 18th century in private asylums. Do you remember in Black Sails, James, his family, because he's homosexual, which was considered a form of madness, his moral insanity, was sent to a colony somewhere in America, which is a private asylum for the very rich, to get rid of troublesome members of their family. Troublesome, embarrassing, whatever. He was homosexual. He wasn't irrational. He's just a homosexual. So you've got things. I think you've got the phenomenon of moral insanity. You know, all those women who had in the 19th century and early 20th century, who had children out of wedlock, were deemed to be morally insane, certified. And their child would be taken from them, and then they'd be locked in the lunatic asylum for the rest of their lives. And it's called moral insanity.
Yeah.
So you see, the definitions are to do with what society wants to do with troublesome people. It's not to say there isn't something going on there. There are these observable phenomena with a certain sort of pattern, certain resemblances, right across the ages and across cultures. But they're interpreted in many, many different ways. They're deemed to mean many, many different things. They're dealt with in many different ways, sometimes with kindness, sometimes with moral exhortation, sometimes with medical treatment, sometimes with drugs, sometimes with surgery, electric shocks, sometimes by just being cared for, sometimes being allowed to wander around the village and treated charitably, but they wander around in the countryside. And so you've got this huge array of both treatments and interpretations and meanings and theories about what causes this stuff. Humours, demons, witchcraft, chemical imbalance, toxin, psychological factors, trauma in childhood, take your pick. You know, so this, so I want to say we're dealing with something as ungraspable as that. Nevertheless, we can picture what's going on.
And it would seem to me that it would be extremely useful for the powers that be to be in control of the definition of madness.
Well, they are.
And as you know, because of the things that you've pointed out, because it's like partly to do with like punishment, yeah. And like,
well, sometimes how, it is. No, it isn't always to do with punishment.
No, not always, but just like sometimes, like it, you know, when it has been. So, for instance, it would be very useful if you have troublesome members of society who are disagreeing with your policies. If you could label them mad and as an excuse to get them locked away, yeah. Then that would be would be quite useful, wouldn't it?
That happens. That happens, you know. And of course, in our society now, by which I mean the UK, but you find it's the same is true in all westernised countries, is that insanity is a matter that comes under law. It's a judicial matter. In the UK, two psychiatrists can sign a paper to detain you for various periods of time, you know, a weekend, 48 hours, I don't know, right the way up to years, without any kind of trial. A policeman can have you detained in a mental hospital on his say-so, as a legal power. So, you know, so they become definitions. The whole thing in modern societies has fallen under law. And psychiatrists, who are the medical doctors, whose speciality is mental illness or madness, do have a lot of judicial power invested in them. They're frighteningly powerful, considering how little they actually know and how still ungraspable this matter remains.
And another point I'd like to bring up here is that been reading about and seen various commentators talking about this idea that mental illness or madness can actually be transmissible. You know, where we see the charismatic leader who lives in a completely alternate reality and manages to persuade huge groups of people, millions and millions of people, that their completely warped version of what is real is true.
Yeah. I mean, that is a whole other topic, and obviously it's very powerful. We saw something like that happening in Nazi Germany, but we also the Trump phenomenon, the cult-like nature of the Trump phenomenon. It's something that one is tempted to explain in terms of a sort of an infectious mass psychosis that a single charismatic leader can induce,
especially when supported every day by Fox News.
Yeah, indeed. You know,
when the voice is very loud, so that's the only voice that people hear.
Yeah.
Or are willing to hear.
Yeah.
So a slight aside, but really, if we're talking about madness, the thing which is most interesting to me right now. At this point in our history is the shared madness between millions of people in America and unfortunately quite a few millions of people in Britain and as well, and of course this is happening in every country but unfortunately when it grows and grows and there's the QAnon and the COVID is a hoax. These people who are living in what I would consider just pure madness, alternative reality that makes no sense.
Yeah.
When actually, if you actually look at the facts, are very dangerous.
Well,
and it's the danger, the danger to societies and the whole world in general. Yeah. That is something that's very pressing on my mind at the moment.
Yeah. No, I am sympathetic to the view, but it's not as simple and straightforward as people think, because it's difficult to find any way in which the consensus reality of Trump followers has got more guarantees as to its reality and truth than the consensus reality of society at large. This is an argument you can have about cults. You can say, well, society is a cult. How is the one better than the other?
Yeah.
Then you can argue in terms of like results. You know, we do not like the results of the Trump cult. We do not like what we prognosticate the results would be should the Trump cult become the universal account of reality of the Western world. We can picture that in our minds. We can extrapolate through imagination what it would be like. We think, no, we don't want that. It'll be a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
But that is talking about the results, potential results, imagined results of a particular worldview getting written large. And that's not the same as indicating that the Trump reality is less grounded in reality, whatever that is, than the consensus reality of you know, your regular people, you might say. Remember, 70 million Americans voted for Trump.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not saying there isn't a way around this conundrum. There may well be. But I can tell you this, it's not going to be very straightforward and easy to delineate and easy to kind of express in an unimpeachable way. Just as far as I can see, like society, any society is a group madness. You know.
Well, every society has to have some sort of shared beliefs that hold them together,
because they need to be able to work together up to a point.
No,
yeah, I mean, this used to be an argument against diverse multicultural societies. The idea was that we've all got to believe the same thing, otherwise society won't function. And that's why witches were burned at the stake, because they didn't believe the church doctrine, you know, and other heretics were killed by the church because the church was saying, you've all got to hold the faith, otherwise we've got no basis for social life. Similarly, communists were persecuted in America in the 50s and jailed and lost their jobs and were ostracised on a similar basis, ultimately, that we all got to believe the same thing. We've all got to read from the same hymn sheet. But you discover modern Britain actually is in world terms, is relatively peaceful. Functions pretty well. And there's every kind of batshit crazy fucking belief in the place. You know, any city of over 100,000 people's got two or three mosques, half a dozen churches, a black charismatic church, a Hindu temple, a Buddhist vihara.
Like a Satanist church and some pagan, God knows, groups and some New Age groups.
Absolutely, you
and
know,
all
and,
sorts.
And a yoga centre, and a couple of yoga centres, and then and followers of Guru Maharaj.
Like Buddhist centres, yeah.
And communists and Marxists, everything. Leninists and Lenin's Marxists and Maoist Leninists, Gramscians and the thing still functions. I was amazing discovery that actually you don't really need to have an overwhelming amount of consensus for a society to function. You don't. I mean, empirically, that is the case, and it's kind of great. I mean, trouble does arise when people whip it up. You know, when demagogues create schism. I certainly say living in Wolverhampton, where 100 languages spoken in the local schools. 100 fucking languages in a medium-sized city. Yeah. And just how you could walk down the road. I saw one act of violence in the last 25 years, you know. You could walk down the road in your carpet slippers, perfectly relaxed. Nobody takes any notice. You know, you can speak to old ladies at the bus stop and it all kind of ticks over astonishingly well. According to Enoch Powell, because we weren't all reading from the same hymn sheet, it was going to be rivers of blood. But, consensus reality, I mean, what is consensus fucking reality, you know? So, though I am sympathetic to wanting to take the plug out of the Trump-tard cesspit, you know, and drying the swamp of it, you know. Take the plug out, let it drain away, because, you know, but I'm thinking more in terms of results than content at the moment. Though I am sort of approaching an argument that does say there is a better way of looking at things. But it's not a formulation that says the consensus reality is better. Okay. All right. Nice now, eh? Yeah. But it is a way that doesn't place, you know, the consensus reality of the average conservative citizen, conservative small c, as being somehow the foundation of sanity and a good way of looking at the world. So one needs something rather different, and I would say it is like critical awareness. Yeah, a certain amount of scepticism, but not a scepticism that goes so far that you then become able to believe anything, like lizards. The Queen's a lizard, you know, and Bill Gates is putting microchips in the coronavirus vaccine, or you know. Yeah. And it is one that gives science a certain weight, but even then, science isn't what we think it is. It's not the final arbiter of everything. It's not. It can't be, and it isn't. You know, and science is full of its own messiness and its own craziness and its own madness. And it gets things wrong, and scientists make mistakes, and scientists can be
prejudiced. Yeah, and also it changes. You know, it's an ever-changing thing, because new discoveries are made.
Well, it changes. Its virtue is that it changes. You know, people got really mad. They say, somebody said, the science has changed. And then people are going mad. Oh, science doesn't change. Yeah. Well, actually, the whole point of science is that you never give up refining what you think you've discovered. And I think we can take that on board as a part of a better way of picturing reality than that that's offered to Trump tards, which is psychological manipulation of people who are in pain. And I believe that that is how we should consider madness. We should consider madness in terms of suffering. The mad person, whatever the cause, which we may never know, you know, maybe when somebody falls so far outside of society that they can't function, and they're either a danger to themselves and others, or just in terrible, or we'll die of starvation without care and attention and compassionate treatment. That we need to understand that we're looking at suffering people, and perhaps abandoning the category of madness altogether, and even the category of mental illness altogether, and realise we're looking at suffering people. So in that sense, I'm still with the old anti-psychiatrist, you know, with Thomas Sazer, who wrote a book called The Myth of Mental Illness. He was a psychiatrist. There was the anti-psychiatry movement in the 60s, of course, with Michel Foucault, who incidentally wrote this huge history of madness called Madness and Civilization. Quite controversial, and I've sort of looked at it as a part of my refreshing my mind on what I want to say about all this. Michel Foucault. The other book I've used is Roy Porter's Madness, which is like a brief history, and that's a short book, small book, a couple of hundred pages, very easy to read, very lucid, absolutely fascinating. It is what it says. Porter is a historian of medicine and psychiatry. He's written 80 books.
But it's 80 books?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Wow.
Very thorough, beautiful short book, very thorough, very authoritative. And it gives you this sweep of all the different explanations of the cause, all the different ways in which it's treated, all the different meanings which are attached to it. But I say let's think that we're facing suffering people when you find somebody who just seems as strange as the birds, you know, or unable to cope. And there but for fortune, we're all in a sense mad, which is another reason I think that self-knowledge entails taking a look at one's own madness, or at least one's own potential for madness. And I see that as a big part of what meditation has to do, if it's very, very serious about itself. You encounter your own mad self. But, you know, I'm sort of in line with some of the Greeks and some of the Indian philosophers who sees also that there can be an inspiration in it. in madness, an artistic inspiration is somewhat mad. You know, there is a kind of a voluntary madness in allowing yourself to be open to artistic inspiration, because you're maybe obsessed and addicted to the beauty of that, you know, and the high of it. So it's not a clear cut thing. Oh, all the Trumptards are mad. The anti-vaxxers are all mad. Even though I do think we need to understand what's going on there with a certain amount of pathology. I also don't think that you understand fascism purely in economic terms, even though you have to tell that story. You also have to do what Erich Fromm did and Wilhelm Reich did and understand it psychologically and to develop a psychopathology of fascism. You have to be very careful with that, because after all, at the end of the day, you're just otherizing somebody with the excuse that they're mad, and we have to do it in such a way that we don't fall for that, you know. So that's where I would kind of heading to with this, is to say we need to understand that mad people, including Trumptards, including anti-vaxxers, are actually in pain. They're suffering human beings. And that we can say, that is where we can anchor ourselves in this matter of trying to discover what reason is by discovering what madness is. And I'm always going to say, in the light of any philosophical investigations, that that oneself is always at stake in the investigation. Even though sometimes that might seem very distant, you get into some rarefied aspects of logic. And yourself, as a kind of individual human being, living through your daily struggles, it seems to be nowhere in sight in those considerations, but actually, you start digging around and you find that it is. And Bertrand Russell asked Wittgenstein, when Wittgenstein was pacing up and down the road, like banging his head on the wall and seeming very, very sort of agitated, and Russell said to him, "Are you thinking about logic or your soul?" And Wittgenstein said, "Both." He couldn't think about logic without thinking about his soul, you know, because he got this kind of will to truth. He wanted to get at it, and it was, but it was a moral failing if he didn't do it, you know. So, I mean, just an example. So I'm saying that we also perhaps attempt to understand our own madness in order to find our own reason. And we realise that people who are actually, you know, just crazy pants by any standard are suffering. And that's it. Yeah. That would be what I would want to say.
So if we were going to take that as how we were going to approach helping someone who was suffering, yeah, how would we use this understanding best to aid them to be suffering less?
Well, that's a really good question. I think I probably don't know the answer to. But I just note this morning reading Bandy Lee, a psychiatrist, forensic psychiatrist, who wrote a book about how dangerous Trump was and what a nutcase he was and how his followers are in this sort of mass psychosis. And she tries to elucidate the mechanisms of that. And she says, the first thing you've got to understand, you can't reason people out of it with logic. Yeah. Even though I do think that
the problem we have with it.
Yeah. I think that those arguments, the logical arguments, have to be out there in the hope that people who are perhaps teetering on the edge of this but still have a logical faculty, still have the faculty of reason, will encounter them, those explanations, and go, "Oh yeah, that's crazy pants, I'm not going there." Somebody deeply immersed in it, you can't get them out of it. By logic, you know. And it might be that what has to happen is, through this understanding, we need to build, you know, the progressive international, you know. So you get the people who can work, whose heart is in human progress, is in defeating the destructive spiral that we're in. And that might entail not trying to persuade the crazy pants people, because you can't, but building what you can with those that you can build with. That might be what has to happen. And even though I say you're faced with a suffering person, and I do think, you know, compassion is one of the highest values, what do you do? What do you do? Maybe what you don't do is round them up and lock them in lock them in cages, you know.
Although the method of denazification,
yeah,
the ones who really couldn't be deprogrammed, they did, yeah, just hang them, didn't they? Yeah. I'm not saying that we should do that now.
They did, yeah. They did.
But I'm just looking at a time, yeah, I know about, where there was a mass deprogramming.
Yeah,
people who just believed in insane stuff.
Well, there was a
Could it be that that only worked because what they did, yeah, was the key players, the influencers,
yeah,
the people who couldn't be persuaded, it was believe or die,
yeah,
were taken out of the equation.
They were, yeah, but by whom, you know? And are they any better?
People who have beliefs, like pretty wacky beliefs of their own, yeah.
By whom, you know? by Americans who only 5 years down the line in the 1950s were absolutely persecuting communists and driving them to suicide,
yeah,
making them lose their jobs, not letting them work in Hollywood and all this, you know. Well, those, yeah, were those people actually, in the essence, any better? What moral high ground do they stand on? This is, you know, the Americans denazified the German Nazis, you know, just a few months, a year.
Was it the Americans, or was that, yep, like a communal effort amongst nations?
I think, well, Germany was conquered by, was divided up between France, Britain, Russia, where they did a completely different programme. And America, I mean, the Americans, the top Nazi rocket scientists, they got took back to America and given posh jobs developing the American intercontinental ballistic missiles to deliver the newly developed atom bombs that they'd just tried out on two Japanese cities. Mm. Okay, in the imperatives of war, maybe that was, you know, unavoidable. You know, this the world is not a utopia, clearly. But,
oh, no.
Nevertheless, I would just repeat the question. You know, the Nazis were denazified. The average German citizen was denazified. But by whom? Mm. By saints? By lily white people? By people occupying some moral high ground? Not really. It might have been a practical necessity, but I mean, I don't think they stand on any kind of moral high ground, or that there's any kind of logical, dare I say, justification, except for the fact, for what they did, except the fact that they won the fucking war, you know. Mm. History is written by the winners.
Yeah.
So we're still in this kind of sticky situation with all this, you know, looking for where we can sort of give it some, I wouldn't say a foundation or a grounding, but some trustworthiness, you know. And madness. I mean, Roy Porter says, well, madness remains a mystery. It was a mystery for Shakespeare, it was a mystery for Plato and Hippocrates, and it's still a mystery. In some sense, there's a certain opening into something vast with madness. It's one of those things that just opens up the minute you start picking around, like we've just done. And what I'm hoping to show is that is what happens.
Yeah.
But it means we have to find our ground in a very certain kind of place, you know, that is to do with understanding suffering, and also it becomes incumbent on us. We are thrown back onto self, like in any philosophy. Ultimately, you're thrown back onto self, like Wittgenstein. Wanted to refine logic, ended up agonising about his soul. You know, you do, I would say, you need to know your own madness, and of course, most people won't. Yeah, in order to find your rationality and your sanity, they are twins. The rational and the irrational are twins. That doesn't mean to say, however, that you can just espouse the irrational. Therefore, this is a mistake. Is that therefore I can believe anything I fucking like, and COVID's a hoax?
Yeah.
You know, and all those doctors who are going on YouTube are lawyers. Not only lawyers, coordinated lawyers. So that's where we need to go with that, I think. Even though I think I've got to do that better, than with a bit more precision. You see how there's some sort of precision needed.
Yeah.
with this, you know.
And also, I think another reason why we can't really come up with a definition of madness is that there's so many different shades.
Of course.
I mean, it could be just almost infinite, really.
Yeah. Well, my schizophrenia is not the same as yours, is it?
No.
No, it's fairly close.
But, so if we understand
we infected each other.
If we understand all, like, say, all the different, many, many shades of madness as, say, having their roots in some kind of suffering, and again, that many, many, many different shades of suffering, aren't there?
Yeah.
Perhaps this could be a useful way to start to look at it when thinking about how to maybe change things, maybe in yourself or in other people.
Yeah. I mean, I think Trumpism works because you've got millions of traumatised people, you know. And, but in effect, you know, with a lot in common vis-a-vis stagnation of wages, offshoring of jobs, the collapse of the American dream, all that kind of stuff. This is real shit, you know, and resentment at the powerlessness. I always think this gets underplayed.
I mean, powerlessness is really it's a real state of suffering. It's horrible to feel powerless.
Yeah,
I think that's a big one.
But somebody comes along who, through his own traumas, has got the understanding, the instinctive understanding. I don't think Trump's got a finely detailed, mechanistic, or intellectual, or analytic understanding of what's going on, but he has a very good instinctive understanding of how to mobilise that resentment.
Yeah.
And I think resentment is key.
Resentment is painful and it's quite suffering as
resentment
well.
Resentment at powerlessness is a key understanding we need to bring to bear on all of these situations. And I think the Marxists and the left need to bite the tongue and consult Nietzsche on that matter. You know.
And what would Nietzsche say?
He'd say it's a huge motivator. That's so huge and so powerful that it's produced entire histories, entire courses of history have been produced by resentment at powerlessness. That's what he'd say. And he was very much a broad brush guy. But I think we have to take it seriously as adding a nuance to our understanding of, you know, alienation, if you want to call it that. You know, I mean, Marx was alert to something of that type going on. But I think we need to nuance it bigly.
Yes, absolutely. We are back nearly down into the town now. So we will round off. And hope you're all doing okay in this difficult time, the pandemic and all that. And I'm sure we will be recording another one soon, so we will speak to you then.